Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We are still have Glenn with us, who has been patient enough to stay through the break. Glenn is proposing the idea that there is nothing inherently wrong with religion, that it is it has many denotations and connotations, and therefore it really shouldn't be used as a pejorative. And we have agreed that the basis of the English word is from the Latin. The Latin is religio, and religio itself is based upon religare, which means to tie fast. So in its base definition, while binding and tying is not necessarily a bad thing, you can tie up a package and that's a good thing. The fact is that Yah's testimony is all about liberation, and his testimony is all about having us walk away from religion. So God has a decided perspective on this issue, and his is very antagonistic towards religion, even though there's no Hebrew word for religion. What say you?
I don't want to, again, belabor the point. Just to point out, politics, for example, in politics relates to polity, mm-hmm. which is a group of people. Whereas the city is a polis, which is where a group of people live.
Right.
So
right.
Politics has to do with the activities and of groups of people. And even today, in your first hour of your show, you're doing politics. In the second mm-hmm. hour of your show, you shift to religion.
No. We're in the first hour of the show. We expose and condemn politics. We don't do politics. We expose and condemn politics. And we also condemn religion. I mean, the first hour of the show is to condemn human institutions, religious institutions, political institutions, military institutions, the economic mindset that is so destructive today. So the first hour of the show is all to condemn human institutions. The second hour of the show is about a relationship with Yahweh. It is anti-religious because Yahweh is anti-religious. He is opposed to every religious scheme. When he does refer to religion, even though there's no Hebrew word for religion, Glenn, he speaks of the promises of the prophets and soothsayers and the spokespeople for religious institutions, for the institutions that make people promises, and he uses his very harshest terms against them. And he calls them frauds. He says they're hypocrites. They say one thing and do another. He says they're robber barons. They cheat people out of their money.
Right.
They manipulate people. Their promises are all false. They prey on people and use deceit and trickery to mislead them. And he says the sad thing about it is that their false promises are far more popular than is his guidance. And he says vastly more people will succumb to the myth and consequence of religion than will afford themselves of the offer that he himself is making.
But and also like harkening back mm-hmm. to yesterday, the general epistle of James or Jacobus mm-hmm. or Santiago, depending on how you do it. But there's one reference in there is, the true religion and undefiled is to visit the widows and the orphans in their affliction. In other words, like he makes a distinction between true religion and undefiled as opposed to corrupt. But again, the issue is purely semantic, and I don't want to ride that out of yours too long.
Yeah, so. I have. I've been a long time, Glenn, since I've attempted to translate Jacob, and so it's going to be a challenge to deal with the statement, and I'm familiar with the statement that is translated into English as is pure religion. And one of these days I'll go into it and see what it's translated into Greek. But recognize that Jacob did not speak Greek. He did not write Greek. He spoke Hebrew. He spoke Aramaic. And so the letter that he wrote was written in either Hebrew or Aramaic, and was translated into to Greek 2 or 3 centuries after he wrote it by someone living probably in Alexandria, Egypt. And so
the
Septuagint is the Septuagint is a reasonable comparison here, because the Septuagint exists as a Greek translation of the Hebrew Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The issue, of course, with the the Septuagint does not include anything that would be nothing of what is errantly called the New Testament. But the problem with the Septuagint is the same problem we have with the manuscripts of the Greek manuscripts of both the eyewitnesses and the historical accounts, which is that by the end of the 2nd century CE of the current era, the variations between various copies of the Septuagint were so extreme that the document became wholly unreliable. And that is because, unlike the Hebrew scribes, who were extraordinarily meticulous, the Greek scribes were typically motivated by religious institutions. They were not meticulous. They felt very comfortable editing the text to serve whatever religious institution they were associated with. And so the Septuagint became an essentially a useless document by the end of the 2nd century CE. And Origen spent the latter half of his life taking what was called the hextapala, where he took multiple copies of the Septuagint and tried to blend them into one that was a consensus document. And unfortunately, that document, his hextapala, has been lost to the ravages of time. But it's the same thing with the Greek text. If you focus on a word, as we're doing here in the Greek text, you really get yourself into trouble, because the text itself is way too unreliable to dive down into the meaning of a specific word unless you have background. And the only way that you can do that is if Yahusha is saying something in Hebrew and it's been translated into Greek, you can go back to the Hebrew passage he is citing and determine what he actually was saying. But in Greek, you have to be really careful.
Right, right. One last thing, since you just mentioned Yahusha.
Yes.
Do you believe that he was crucified? Or,
belief is a term that I would never use. You can know. I wouldn't even use doctrine as a term, because that has religious connotations. We know exactly what happened to Yahusha, because there's an eyewitness account of precisely what happened to Yahusha that was written 700 years before it occurred. So the most effective, detailed eyewitness account of what Yahusha endured was written by Yahweh through his prophets, primarily through the prophet Yahshayahu, Isaiah, but also in Psalm through Dode at 1000 BCE, Psalm 22 and Psalm 88 show that his fulfillment of Pesach Passover would endure the trial. It would endure the lashings, where literally the flesh was ripped from his body. It would endure him being set on the upright pole, because the upright pole is the symbol of the doorway to life. And it would depict the kind of physical death of his body. Not God didn't die, but the physical body, as the Passover lamb, suffered that consequence, that penalty, if you will. But it's actually a consequence, not a penalty, death. But it specifically goes into the kind of terror that crucifixion inflicts on the body. And it talks about dying of thirst, but yet the lungs being filled with fluid, which is one of the things that happens to a crucifixion victim. It speaks of the heart melting away with inside of a person, zapping their strength, which is one of the things that happens to a crucifixion victim. It talks about all of the joints being pulled out of their sockets, which is something that happens to a crucifixion victim. In fact, in Zechariah, it even says, speaks
not
of...
Not Testament.
You know? Yeah, yeah, and his bones were not broken because typically the bones are broken and the shins are broken because the way that you survive the agony of crucifixion for a day as opposed to hours is that you push up on your feet against the nails in your feet, and if you push up, then you can breathe. But if you're just hanging by your arms, your diaphragm doesn't work and you can't breathe, so you suffocate. So it speaks of that kind of death in the eyewitness accounts in Psalm 22 and Psalm 88. And then it also speaks of the joints being pulled out of their sockets. And then in Zechariah, it actually speaks of Yahweh saying when he returns that he is the one whom we pierced, whom we nailed. And the Hebrew term is, you know, we drove nails through. And it actually speaks of driving nails through his hands and his feet. So the kind of symbolic death that Yahusha, as the Passover lamb, suffered is presented, and it depicts crucifixion. Now, it was not on a cross. Not in the symbol of the Christian cross. If you look at a capital T versus the lowercase t, where the cross beam goes across the very top, that's how the death stakes were created then. The Christian cross is based upon the pagan crosses of sun gods of old. It's not on a cross. There's no Hebrew word for cross. There's no Greek word even for cross. The word cross is actually a derivative of the Latin, which was used to replace sura, which was the upright pole. So, yes, his physical body as the Passover lamb was crucified on the doorway to life, representing Passover. God himself did not die, because what was his last words? He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? What that should tell people is go to the 22nd Psalm, where that's the opening line of the Psalm. He's quoting it because the 22nd Psalm explains exactly what was happening to him then, and what would happen to him on Matzah, and what would happen to him on Bokorim. It's all presented in the 22nd Psalm, and that's why he draws our attention to it. But the Spirit of God, because God cannot die, had to go back to heaven, and it's just the physical body that died on the upright pole. Even his soul, which typically represents whether we're alive or dead, his soul could not die because his soul had to suffer the indignity of the penalty of separation for God, because his soul was slathered with our sin. And so his soul on Matzah on the Shabbat went into Sheol to resolve the issue of our sin and redeem us. And then on Bokorim, on firstborn child, which is what the day means, his soul and Yahweh's spirit were reunited, and he was a new creation. We'll continue with this story after the commercial break. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I want to see if we have completed our Q&A for today with Glenn, who I always appreciate calling in. I actually enjoy our discussions, Glenn. And then we've got Rod, who is called in from Indiana. So, Glenn, have we pretty much pummeled your questions for today?
We can finish about another day about what became of the body of Yahusha.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I would love for you to do that. Could you, would you mind calling in another day and we can talk about what we've done?
Day.
Right.
By the way, what's today? What's today? What day of the week is today?
We would call today Wednesday. In English.
You caught me. I was going to say you'll quibble with me about the word doctrine, but you'll still go ahead and call it Woden's Day. But anyway, thank you.
Yeah. You know, Glenn, you make a good point in the sense that we really can't communicate in English and not use words that are laden with a pagan past. Wednesday is based upon Woden's Day. Sunday is based upon homage to the sun god. Monday is based upon homage to the moon god. Saturday is based upon homage to Saturn, the god of war. And so it is true that our our words are based upon that. And if we were to call Wednesday the fourth day of the week, that was the Hebrew scriptural designation, is this day that we call Wednesday would be called day four. The problem is that with that, if I were to say it's the fourth day of the week, no one listening would understand what we're talking about.
Exactly. So, which is why I allow a little bit of leniency myself. It's a lot, you know.
I do too. I do too on
yeah.
Right. I do on vocabulary. I think that's. I think it's a reasonable thing to do on vocabulary because we just can't rid ourselves of terms that have pagan past and still communicate. That being the case, let's go to Rod, and Rod wants to talk about tithing. Hello, Rod. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Adam. I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Malachi, well, it's probably Malachi or something like that, from third chapter, verse 7 and 8, from the days of your fathers you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Lord of hosts. But you say, how shall we return? And then in verse 8 it says, when man robbed God, yet you have robbed me. But you say, how have we robbed you? And then it says, in tithes and offerings. Now, do you know if this is the New American Standard, if in
right.
the, I don't know if they have this portion is in the Dead Sea Scrolls or not.
The kind of study that what you're suggesting here is to look up each word, find out what the basis of each word is in Hebrew, and then check to see if that portion of Malachi is the Hebrew word for spiritual messenger. What we call angels are actually Malak. And so Malachi's name is based upon the Hebrew word for spiritual messenger. But what you're asking is the right approach, which is if you're going to determine what something says, what God is saying, the first thing you have to do is read it in context. You know, what is the context of this statement? And you have to go typically to the beginning of a particular discussion, and you have to go beyond the statement that you're interested in to ascertain its meaning. Because the moment you pull something out of context, you've lost the ability to understand what is being said. The second thing you have to do is to see if that statement is recorded in amongst the Qumran scrolls, because what's happened here is that while the Qumran community and really the history of Hebrew manuscript retention is extremely good by almost any standard, if you're dealing with issues that could have implications to the Judaism, to the religion of the Jews, then you're dealing with about a 15 to 20% variance. So there are places where things have been altered that could potentially have a religious influence. For example, when you're dealing with any prophecy regarding the Messiah, Yahusha, heavy, heavy hand in copy editing. And in this particular statement, which could be used by religious individuals, heavy hand in copy editing. So therefore, it's really helpful to be able to access the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what I'll do real quickly here is I'll why don't you give me the passage again, and let me see if I can look it up over the break.
Okay, Malachi 3:7-8.
Okay, let me look it up and see what I can find for you. Okay, we'll be back with Shattering Myths in a moment. I'm your host Yetta. We're having a discussion now about the nature of tithes and offerings. It was a question brought up by Rod, who's has called in from Indiana. So the first question we need to ask is whether or not this statement is recorded among the Qumran scrolls, because the Masoretic text, which forms the basis of English translations of what's called the Old Testament, there is no Old Testament, just the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, was vocalized using a Shaba system, which was specifically designed to, well, the word Shoah means to corrupt. So it's a system based upon corruption, and it was created by religious rabbis, Masoretes, in the 11th century of this era. And as a result, you're dealing with a document that's edited, that is actually manipulated for a religious purpose. If you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, which at least take us back, depending on the particular text, between 1,000 years and 1,200 years more distant before the influence of the Masoretes, you do find that we do have an extant copy of Malachi, the book now known as Malachi. The third chapter is extant in it, and there is a snippet from the seventh verse. Unfortunately, and also a snippet from the eighth verse. But this is what is missing from the eighth verse. Will a man rob God, yet you, and then that is missing. What you have is rob me, and then missing again, but you say, how have we robbed you in the tithes and offerings? That is missing. So what you then have is an interesting in that the ninth verse starts out entirely different than the Masoretic. So the part, so we're going to have to question what is written in the Masoretic as it relates to the ending of the eighth verse, which is not extant, because the beginning of the ninth verse, and by the way, they're not broken down into verses, it's just one continuous thought here, not even broken into independent sentences in the Hebrew. The ninth verse in the Masoretic says, you are cursed with the curse, is how the ninth verse begins. But listen how the ninth verse actually begins in the Qumran Scrolls. You were looking on appearances. Okay, so it's entirely different. And so since it's entirely different, you are looking on appearances versus you are cursed with a curse, you're going to really have to question what would precede it. Now, that being the case, let's just see what is in the Masoretic. It begins with a interrogative. The interrogative is in this particular case is ha. There are several ways to pose a question in Hebrew. The interrogative is, and it's a truth in many cultures. You use a word that you actually don't speak, but it's a word that that says, read this with the inflection of a question. And so in this particular case, it is ha. And so it becomes how have you or in what ways have we robbed, or just God asking a question. And so it says, will he rob, if we're asking it as a question? When it's, and who's he here? He here is the Hebrew word Adam. Adam, there are five or six Hebrew words for humankind. Enosh is mortal men. Adam is depictive of man with a nesama, with that unique conscience. And then there's Ish, which speaks of an individual. But there's many Hebrew words for man. The one that's used here is Adam. So it's speaking of mankind. Mankind, will he rob God? Or is he robbing God? It's being posed as a question. Because you and then are robbing me. So God is saying, is humankind robbing God? Because indeed you are robbing me. And then it says, and you say, in what way, how, again, as a interrogative, have we robbed you? Now, the word for rob here is kaba. Kaba means to exploit. It's to plunder through usually force, but also through deception. So what are the ways that people are mostly plundered through force or deception? Either through military conquest, political conquest, or religious conquest, right?
Right.
So you exploit and you plunder. Now, you exploit through deception by religion. You plunder by force through military conquest. And so since the Israelites were not engaged in military conquest, you would have to read this, particularly at the time that it's that Yahweh was revealing this statement through Malachi. The Israelis had absolutely no military conquest. So since it's not by force, it has to be by deception. So if you exploit by deception, we're dealing with religion, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So mankind will rob God because you are exploiting through deception me. And you say, how are we exploiting you through deception? And then it just says the tithe and the offering. It doesn't say that the tithe and the offering are should have been given to God. It doesn't say that the tithe and the offering are associated with God. It just says, God is saying, the way that you are exploiting through deception is the tithe and the offering. So think about that. Think about that. What that means. We've resolved that the word for plundering conveys one of two things: robbing through plundering through force, which does not apply because the Israelites did not have a military at the time. They were not doing that, or exploiting through deception, which is religion. So we've got religious plundering going on here. All right, and then God says the answer, the way that you are exploiting through deception, is through tithes and offerings, which would be a religious concept. So rather than God saying you're stealing from me because you're not providing the tithes and offerings, It's more saying your deployment of tithes and offering are exploiting this relationship between me and my children.
20 years ago, I was a member of a church that took three tithes, and then they wanted offerings on top of that.
Yeah, that's what they take this passage out of context. They mistranslate it to say that you are required to provide a tithe, which is a tenth part, and then you have to give offerings above that. I was an elder in a church, and I collected tithes and offerings too, and it was always presented as it's a mandatory obligation for you to present 10% of your income, and then your offering is over and above that. It's what the Mormonism is predicated on. But that's not what this says. It says that the tithe and offering is the way that men through religious deception are exploiting God's children.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, the word for tithe, by the way, is maaser. In this case, in the passage that we were looking on regarding the word that was translated tithe related to Shavuah seven sevens, that was Isharon. And I made a point to say, you know, the word that is typically translated tithe is not what was used here. And so beyond the fact that this was a double portion of bread, and it was something that the people were receiving by coming into Yah's presence, not the something that they were giving. And so Isharon, we came to realize, is a tenfold increase in enrichment and empowerment, which is the benefit of Shavuah. God's children are enriched and empowered tenfold as a result of the celebration of Shavuah. But here, it's not Isharon, it's Maaser. And Aser is the word for ten, but it's also the word for enrichment and empowerment. So, and it begins with Ma. Now, Ma can be one of the interrogatives in Hebrew. It's not a word by itself, but when it is presented as a word, it's typically presented as an interrogative, but it's usually with the alf, not with the ain. So in this particular case, I looked up what Hebrew words contain the M-A, the meh ain as two letters and very few other letters following it. And what you find is words like extortion. You find words like robbing. You find words like being a doorkeeper to a temple. You find words that convey work and practices of work. Now, one of those words that begins with ma'ase is the basis of Messiah. It's actually ma'ase ya, written very similarly, m-ain. And so ma'ase is the Hebrew word for work, ma'ase ya being the title, the work of Yahweh. So when you realize what follows in this particular statement, you are looking at on appearances. And so your perspective is to create an appearance, is what God is saying. So if you tie that together with what he's just said, which is that how are you extorting and through deceit me? Through the tithes and through the offerings, and what he follows that with is to create appearances, you know, to create the perspective, the appearance, of course, that you're doing something right when you're not.
Okay.
So it's one of my favorite things to do, and you've brought it up here, Rod, is to go into, and this is what I think you've done, because I've spoken against tithes and offerings, that God is not interested in us donating our money or 10% of our income to any religious institution, is go into a passage that seems to say otherwise and find out what it really says. And in this particular case, as in every case I've ever done, you find that God is always consistent. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Rod, who is called in from Indiana, on a passage in Malachi. It's 3:7 and 3:8. And during the break, I had a little bit of time to look up the root. Now, we were talking about how God's saying, you know, you're exploiting through deception. We found out that he had to be talking about religion here, because there's only two ways to rob based upon the term that he chose for rob. And it was to exploit through deception. So we're talking about religious thievery here. And God is chastising these religious types for robbing his children. And then, so I had a chance to drill down on the word that was chosen here for tithe, which is completely different than the word on seven Shabbat, which was isharon, meaning a tenfold enrichment and a tenfold empowerment. And as I was drilling down on the roots of ma'ashar, found something quite interesting. You go all the way down to the point where Strong's, which is the best concordance as it relates to roots, where it says, that's all I got for you. Here is the ultimate root of ma'ashar. Listen to this, and think of this in the context of religious leaders enriching themselves and of creating appearances that they are worthy. Here's the definition of the root of the word that God chose to communicate here. To become rich or wealthy, to enrich oneself, to pretend to be rich, to become rich, to gain riches, and to enrich oneself while pretending to be rich. And then he concludes that with, all for the purposes of appearances to be seen as such.
Well, it sounds like evangelical Christianity ministry, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. Like the televangelists and all of those guys with their hand out saying, you know, I want your tithes and offerings. Send me your checks. It absolutely does. And so the very passage they're quoting is a passage where God is condemning the tithes and offerings being used in a religious environment. He says that you're enriching yourselves to create the appearances of being worthy. And then even the word for offering is interesting here. It is taruma. It is a word that its basis is room, which means to rise up, to elevate oneself. How do religions rise up and elevate themselves? They rob the people. They use their money to rob them. One of even the lead definitions of taruma is to bribe, to take as a quid pro quo. For example, the Roman Catholics with their indulgences. So you bribe them for special favors. That's one of these specific meanings of the word. So it's a condemnation of the indulgences of Roman Catholicism and how even today, you know, if you're a Roman Catholic and you've committed some grave offense and you go into the priest, you know, he's going to tell you to do two things. One is recite a bunch of Hail Marys, which is a pagan thing, and then make a donation. It's the same kind of stuff. God hates what religion does in terms of extorting people. And this is not his only statement on the matter. You know, throughout the book of Jeremiah, God is constantly railing against religion. The entire book is against religion. And in the case of Jeremiah, the enemy isn't the Jewish religion, it's Gentile religions, because the book is written to Gentiles. So the concluding comment that I was trying to make at the end of the last segment, Rod, is that every time that we've had the opportunity to investigate a statement that seems to contradict what we've come to know about Yahweh, that he is not interested in our money, and that God despises the extortion and deceit of religious institutions where they enrich themselves by plundering the people. That if you find a passage that seems to disagree with that, most likely it's because it's erroneously translated. And that is the case here, is it not?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'm glad I asked this question.
I'm glad you did, too. I'm always confident in Yahweh being consistent. And I'm always confident of him never coming out of character, never saying anything that contradicts anything that he has previously revealed. I don't have the same level of confidence with my own ability to quickly ascertain what he has said and be able to search the resources like in this particular case, the Qumran scrolls were absolutely essential to our understanding of this passage. And also was the actual words as they appear in the Hebrew text. And so to do this on the fly is always a bit of trepidation, but I am really glad you asked the question. Call back again.